Hello and welcome to today's Born Human podcast. As ever, it is another privileged day for me to introduce to you our guest today, Mr. Ben Akers. Ben is someone who I came to meet a few years ago through a documentary he made called Steve, which looked at male mental health and male suicide. Sounds a pretty heavy subject, right? But actually, it was a really proactive and productive documentary that is really making a difference. And the outcomes from that, Ben has now set up a charity which is called Talk Club, and he's also making a new film called Our Kids, Our Lives, which is my main reason for having him on the podcast today, apart from the fact that he's a really interesting guy. He also has three children and he's very interested in looking at now kids' mental health and kind of what we can do with that going forward. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. He's a really lovely guy and this is a wonderful hour of my life, so sit back, relax, and take it away. Welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Today I am privileged to be joined by someone that I was introduced to a little while ago, Ben Akers. So Ben is someone that I came across through his amazing film, The Steve documentary, which we'll talk about a bit on the podcast. But yeah, so today we're talking about his family and his journey in parenthood. So welcome to today's podcast, Ben. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks for coming all the way over to Bristol to see me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Get us a tour past Ashton Gate and away. It's brilliant. Yeah. Ben and I met through Steve and kind of that sort of thing, but we've come to sort of know each other better through Talk Club and that kind of thing. But you are a proud parent of little monsters as well, right?
So. Yeah. I've got three. I've got a 3-year-old, a 6-year-old, and my biggest has just turned 9 as of 10 days ago or something.
Regular gaps.
Yeah, 2.5 years.
So you should be due another one now, right?
No, definitely not. Luckily, the NHS helped me out on that one. So.
It's not irreversible, apparently. I've got a friend of mine who's going through that at the moment, and he said she was agreed that at 3, that was the end of it. And then his wife said, can we just have one more? And he's like, no, I agreed. The NHS did its job. We're not going back there kind of thing. But so, yeah, so 3 kids. And how, so they're at sort of primary, they're not all at school yet?
No, the little one is at P school, not preschool, because she hasn't nailed her R's yet. P school. And the other two, are just around the corner, Ashton Gate.
Yeah. And how... So you live in Bristol. Were you always in Bristol when you had your kids? Have you been there since you started?
No, so my eldest was born in Sydney. And the middle one was born in Warrington. So we lived in Sydney for 6 years. Then we came back and we lived in just outside Manchester. And he was born in Warrington. And the little one is a proud Bristolian. So we sort of... it's interesting with their characters. Like the eldest is... It sort of thinks that she's... She lives by the sea and sort of the hair's going and everything like that. The middle one, my boy, runs into brick walls and expects them to move. And the little one is the cheekiest and probably going to be the one that's going to make me the money. But she's sort of like she's more she's only 3, but she runs the place really.
Yeah. And did you always plan on having 3? Is that always your thing?
I don't know if I planned it. I like big families. I come from 3. I'm the middle one with 2 sisters. I do like having lots of noise around me. I like it now because it's quiet. But I love being a dad. I do love being a dad. It's full on, but I love being a dad. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, it's. I guess nothing in life's worth having if it's not worth working hard for, if you know what I mean. And the kids certainly make you work for it, don't they?
Yeah, I think the thing is we sort of... I always try and make life as difficult as for myself as possible and try and push as much as I can. And I think even with kids, it was a lot easier to stop at 2. But with 3, like one of my friends is just about to have 3 and I sort of said like, it just changes dynamic of everything. You just sort of feel like apart from am I allowed to swear on this?
You can do whatever you like.
Apart from having as when I told my friends as like I'm gonna have 3, he goes, oh, you gotta buy a shit car now or a shitter car now. But it's I found very much like that 3 for me was a complete thing. It's just like we're a little gang and And I think it's really hard now with parenting because I think there's so much pressure that you put on. Like I've got friends who've just got one and have fought very hard to have one, like with IVF and sort of stuff like that. And then people who have decided that their lot is two, and that's great as well, and that's good for them. But there was no way that I was only going to have two, or even one, if we were allowed, if biology was going to let us happen.
Yeah.
So I feel very lucky, but also, I'm sort of greedy for life. I like life, and having three kids is definitely greedy. So.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, it's amazing. Like, if you're prepared to dedicate the time to, I'm finished at two. Like, I'm done at two. I forgot. There's two pairs of hands. There's two of us. There's two of them. That feels like a sweet number. I'm a maths man, so, like, you know, that all adds up for me. It's a square. It's sort of all these sorts of things.
Oh no, we're outnumbered. I'm taking the three of them to drop them all off this morning because my wife left at 7:30. So I've got the little one on my shoulders. I've got one there and one there, and we're walking along sort of quite thin things. I'm banging them off. Quite thin paths, and banging them off cars, banging them off bins. It's sort of like, yeah, it's definitely a sight. But yeah, it's one of these things, especially for me. I suddenly got my purpose. I suddenly realised why I was actually on the planet when I had my kid in Sydney. And I knew it was going to happen. I knew it was sort of going to be that moment of, like, I wanted kids. But suddenly you realise, like, it was just like proper penny drop going, that's why you're here, Ben. Yeah. And I think that obviously takes a lot of responsibility, but very much that taking that everything else on and being, I completely reshaped my life since I had kids.
Yeah.
I had to, so.
Yeah, and how long were you in Sydney for? Presumably it was planned having kids, having your first kind of thing. Or?
Yeah. I mean, we were in Sydney for 6 years. We got married back here after two, and then we had my oldest at, again, we left just before she was two, so it was probably a 2-2-2.
Yeah.
And then and we came back here just before she was two, and that was the thing, like, we landed here, we've been back for 10 days, and then that's when I found out Steve took his life.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like very, like, whoa, emotional stuff. But yeah, it was a very much planned, in as much as you can plan these things.
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? How that kind of, I don't know about you, and obviously it's your experience of it. And I know we've spoken before, as in I lost one of my childhood friends to it as well. And there's this weird kind of sense of, like, trying to make peace with kind of what's happened in terms of losing someone. And when a baby comes into the equation at the same time, it feels kind of almost, I don't know, like some sort of savior, almost, of like, well, you know, that's a terrible thing, but there's an amazing life still being born, if you know what I mean. And there's some sort of salvation in that, I think. I was pretty young when that happened to me, but how did you, I mean, Steve is obviously, you were close when you were kids kind of thing and that, but, and obviously the documentary is amazing in terms of what it's done for changing people's outlooks. And, but how did that, what sort of settled you on a path of working out that you needed to do, Steve? What was it that got you to that point?
Well, I mean, when we came back, we'd been in Sydney, Steve and, his wife and his two kids were in Canada, and I'd not met them. I'd not met his wife. I'd not met his kids. I only met his wife at his funeral.
Yeah.
And actually, Steve's son is, his birthday is the same age as my oldest, and same birthday. And it's just like, so it's all really weird inside all these coincidences.
Yeah.
But I mean, it took me a while. I sort of, like, I did 3 years of trying to sort of a lot of therapy and trying to work out what I needed to do. And when I was in Sydney, I was in big advertising companies and sort of stuff like that, and I'd be leaving early in the morning and back late at night. And when we had one, you try to sort of fit your life, them into your life, right? Yeah. That's what you try and do. You sort of, like, you go, okay, well, I'm going to take them to the childminder here, and then you will pick them up here, and we'll pick them up there, and you try and reshape your life. And then when we came back and we wanted, obviously, we wanted another visit from the stork. And you sort of like, you realise when you have two, you've got to change your life to fit them now.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And I try to sort of explain this to sort of mates when sort of like who've got, who are having that, making that jump between one and zero and one and one and two and even two and three. And I sort of said, the biggest leap is zero and one.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to hold on. For me, it was always just trying to hold on to your previous life.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you have between two and three, between sort of one and two, like when you have two, my friend said to me, you know all that spare time you've got? And when you've got one, you go, I've got no spare time. Go, in the toilet on your own is spare time.
Yeah.
Right? And then suddenly all that spare time has just disappeared.
Yeah.
And then when you have three, look, you're on the floor being kicked, you might as well just stay there. And it's sort of like, it's literally with three, there is just nothing. I mean, like, even the shower today, like this morning, my wife walks in, the three kids are in there, the cat stroll's in, and we've got a tiny bathroom, and I'm trying to have a shower here. And it's like, but that's the thing when it happens with time. And I think what happened with me was sort of with that evolution. I mean, Steve and me is really interesting because I gravitated towards his family very much. So, yeah. So my family and these things, and their family is such a loving family. And he developed over there so he'd grown into a father. We'd never seen each other as fathers.
Yeah.
It was really, really interesting. And we were aiming to sort of catch up and stuff like that, but we never got, because he was a big Man United fan. I was living in Manchester. I'd sorted out some tickets. And he was going to come up and see me, but we never got to that.
Never
stage.
Happened.
Never got to that stage. So I sort of spent. So as I say, I spent 3 years trying to do that, and then it was very much of 3 months, 3 years of trying to work out my feelings towards all this, because I'd never been confronted with suicide before.
Yeah.
And then got to a point where we were actually probably the first time I'd switched off in 3 years. I was in a hammock in my in France, and I was flicking through a magazine that I picked up from, like a Sunday Sup magazine.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of like, and I read in this magazine that men of my age watch sport and documentaries.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, that's what I need to do. I need to make a film. And I'd read earlier in that magazine that suicide was the biggest killer of men under 45 at that stage.
Yeah.
And it was like, this magazine, I really want to find it. Like, this magazine was almost like that turning point in my life, because it's actually where we've got to now with Talk Club. Now it's a charity, and the amount of men we're helping. This magazine actually kicked me to sort of go, okay, you need to do something with your grief. You need to take the little skills you've got and try and sort of channel them into this something. So that was where, that was that moment of that, in that hammock, was the moment that sort of came about. And I asked my wife, I sort of said to her, well, I didn't ask her, I said to her, I need to make a film about Steve. She said, I don't want you to. And I was like, I think I need to. She goes, I think it'll be a major mistake. I don't want you to, because I think it'll bring up too many bad feelings. I don't think you're emotionally strong enough. And I was like, okay, I'm going to dial up my therapy. I need to.
Yeah.
And it was a one of the toughest things I've ever done. But I look back on it and I'm very proud of what we achieved.
Yeah.
And I feel like we, people ask me what would Steve make of it? He'd bloody hate it. He'd sort of like, he was quite a shy bloke, and he'd hate the idea of a big poster of him, of his face and sort of his name. But that was his choice when he decided, when he pushed into this thing, and these things unfolded and he left us. He left me to hero him.
Yeah. So make some sense of it.
Yeah.
And do something with it. And
yeah.
I think there's no, you know, bad things happen in the world, and that is tragic and it's terrible. But if you can't sort of do something with it to make something positive out of it, then it just becomes a tragedy and nothing else, right? Whereas actually, from the ashes of all of that grief and sadness comes something really great for other men, which is, unfortunately, doesn't change anything for Steve, but it does change the outcomes of others, right? And that's incredible, right? What has it done for your... How does it change your outlook on your own kids? And I guess because you were childhood friends as well, right? And so what was your childhood like, and what is that? You know what I mean? There's like your own childhood. And as parents, we all go through this, that sense of like, well, when I was a kid, this is what I kind of went through. Mm. I want more of this, less of that. And then obviously, so you've had those experiences, but then as a parent now, you sort of think a bit differently.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why me and Steve became friends was because of his family. And it was, I mean, my family, like my dad was mentally ill when I was younger. He was sort of schizophrenic, and we were in a battered wives and child hostel and refuge, and sort of so very much. I mean, I didn't know any different. Do you know what I mean? This was my childhood. Like, my mum's this and my dad's this, and everything's the way it is. But my dad was mentally ill, and he got committed and everything like that. And it was a hell of a lot of strain on my mum. And so then, sort of like through my primary school, I look back on it, and I had a very unstable way of looking at everything. Was quite unstable, but my mum did her best to stabilise stuff. And then my teens were very much me trying to find, as every teenager is, trying to find your own space. But it was a very confusing area because of what had happened at home and my stepdad sort of coming in. And my stepdad's a great influence in my life, but he's sort of a very different character to me and my and he's softened in his older years, but he was quite a cold person to start with.
Yeah.
But Grandpa Steve is a lot more warmer now than he was when we were growing up. And I think because Steve's family is proper salt of the earth, lovely working class family, and you walk in and everyone just hugs you and he's just all over you like glue, do you know what I mean? It's just, you can't escape. And they are like that now, even with my kids now, when we go down and see them in the South Coast. I mean, literally, my wife Claire doesn't know them. Straight away it's hugging and then they can't escape, and the Yateses are just all over you. And I spent most of my from sort of 11 to sort of, I'd say, 21, like, I was called the Lodger. I was there all the time. And I was a second son. I went on holiday with them. I went on holiday with them more than I went on holiday with my own family.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, sort of like the way that all panned out, because in theory, if you were looking at the thing, like, I'm the one who should be sort of like having the mental health issues.
Yeah.
But what was happening was that sort of because almost Steve was so having, and not saying I didn't have my own mental health issues, but sort of like, but Steve had came from such a loving background that there was lots of other things going on that he didn't feel, because he came from that world where you don't talk about your feelings.
Yeah.
And those things manifested in sort of when he became a father was when talking to his wife was when things started changing, because he didn't know how to cope. He didn't know how to handle these things. And it's hard. It's really, really hard. And I talk a lot to blokes now who are becoming fathers for the first time, or stress or stuff like that, of those sort of like moments of rejection and use and sort of stuff like that. And I think that those were the things that if I could have started Talk Club 10 years ago, or 10 years before Steve died, I mean, it'd be 7 years this Friday.
Yeah.
If I could have started Talk Club 15 years ago, then he would still be with us, because I think he just needed that outlay. He just needed to be able to sort of talk about, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
But I don't think we did have the skills in those days.
No, I mean, generationally it's changed enormously, which I think is obviously for the better, but there's still a long way to go with it. But it's interesting what you say there, like, as an observer, kind of seeing your situation being really quite complicated growing up and the world at large, if they were given your facts and said, actually, we need to look after this kid's mental health because there's a lot going on for him. And, you know, I guess for Steve, coming from outwardly what looks like a really healthy place, loving family, all those kind of things, you're kind of, as friends, you're kind of being pulled into this bubble, but still getting support potentially because you know there's stuff going on for you. But for him, it's kind of like, well, I don't know where to go with this stuff, because by rights, I've got a really long family and I always get a hug when I come home and all that kind of stuff. But we're not talking about the important stuff. And what does that mean for, where do I go with that kind of thing?
And I think the thing is as well, I send Les, Steve's dad, a Father's Day card each year, And I sent him this note in it. And I did it at the same time. I sent my stepdad a letter and sort of told him I loved him, right? Because I don't think blokes tell blokes they love them enough, yeah. Right? And I told Les that I loved him and I told him why I loved him. And a lot of the way that I am silly with my kids was because of Les. Do you know what I mean? The way that Les was silly with us, with me and Steve and Steve's sister, Claire, I'd see that and I go, that's how you should act as a father.
Yeah.
And I have taken a lot of those things on because there was my father figure was quite strange when I was growing up. There was my stepdad who was trying to fit into this family, and then my dad who was ill and never really there. And it was so it's always really bizarre sort of ways these things get together, and it's so interesting how they both reacted to me writing this letter.
Yeah,
my stepdad jumps on a plane and comes over, and sort of like he's never really owned a relationship with my grandkid, his grandkids, even though they know call him Grandpa Steve.
Yeah,
but he always comes over with my mum, so he jumps on a plane and comes over and sees us, and hangs out with us for a weekend. We have a hug, we have a good talk, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Les, got your letter, cheers, right? And it's sort of like, and I know from Steve's sister that sort of like, that he was really thankful for it, and he was sort of like, and there was a little tear and stuff.
Yeah.
But even with then, like I was pouring my heart out, I was being vulnerable, I was saying about all these things that were important to me. And Les, even though I know they're important to him, wouldn't break over that barrier. And it's really hard with something like suicide, is that the parents just take on all this blame and all this thing, and it's nothing to do with them. It's to do with society and the way that they were treated, that they are only ever doing their best, and sort of like, and everyone's only ever doing their best. So it was, but Les and Lowell always blame themselves. They always will do. There's nothing more I can say. No one, anything else can anyone can say.
Yeah.
About what happened. But it's one of these things where you go, we need to be all as a society now with our kids, is to try and teach them that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to talk about how you're feeling. You don't have to keep that stiff upper lip. You don't have to bottle it up. You don't have to sort of suck it up.
Yeah.
I mean, like I used to hear sort of like football all the time. Take a cement pill, harden the F up. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, because that's the way this sort of, that is how you deal with emotion. That's how you sort of like, you don't say that bothers me. And that's one thing that I've learned a lot in the past 3 years since finishing Steve, the film, and creating Talk Club, is that, that's my wife's head in, but I'm sort of like, I'm uncomfortable with this.
Yeah,
I'm going to talk about this now, and I'm feeling vulnerable now, and I'm feeling flat now. And she's like, she goes to me the other day, I fucking liked it more when you kept everything to yourself. And it's like, but the thing is, you go like, no, I like, and the way that Talk Club works is all about numbers. How are you out of 10?
Yeah.
So I do that every single morning. I'll go, okay, I'm a 5 now, and how do I get myself to a 6? I'm going to go to the gym.
Yeah.
I'm going to reward myself. I'm going to go to the gym, or I'm going to ring someone positive, or I'm going to put on some nice music. And because I'm going to self look after myself, which I didn't know how to do any of that before.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to teach with my kids. I like, even with my eldest this morning, she had a bit of a rough day yesterday. So this morning, what number are you out of 10? Let's talk about what happened yesterday. How can you take things differently today? How can you sort of not let that over that slight bullying thing that I've interpreted here overrun today?
Yeah.
And maybe my parents did do that, but I don't remember those conversations. I
don't think it was a thing, was it? Like, no. Certainly, I imagine there were pockets of people that did, that had that emotional intelligence. But also, even if you had the emotional intelligence, it wasn't society telling you this is the right thing to do. Because it's kind of like, there's that old sort of like saying of nip things in the bud, right? Get it early. And the problem with mental health is that if you don't deal with all the little things that go with it, if you don't catch them early, then they become bigger and bigger problems. And then, you know, what starts out needing a pair of prunes to take down, you know, becomes a chainsaw, then becomes a digger. Do you know what I mean? And then you're like, I can't, how do I cope with that? And I can't drive a digger. So, do you know what I mean? Like,
This is the thing. I mean, that's the reason why we talk about mental fitness, right? Talk Club is all about mental fitness. Because when I, in the film, when I talked to a rugby player called Daniel Sculthorpe, he said to me, he introduced me to that idea. And I suddenly, it was like, boom. Like light bulb goes on, because when you talk, especially with men, when you talk to about them about mental health, we don't know what the fuck that means.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's sort of like automatically people go mental health, you go to the negative. You go to mental... You hear mental health, but you... But someone says mental health, you hear mental illness.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And... But then when you compare it, you put fitness there and you compare it to physical fitness.
Yeah.
And you go, so it's a scale. And if it's a scale, it doesn't happen to me, I can change it.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of, I mean, my mum, after everything that happened with my dad, my mum reacted in her way and she became a counsellor. She became a therapist. And she's the reason why I can do all these things. She's the reason why I was able to talk, because my relationship with my mum has always been so open that if I'm overwhelmed by anything, I'll just get straight on the phone to her. And I've got a world-class counsellor on speed dial 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reason why I can take on so many of these emotional things and be a lot more open with that. But especially over the past 3 years, taking these things that I've learned throughout my 20s and 30s and now sort of like into my 40s and going, okay, well, you can take all those skills and mash them all together and now you can start helping others, which I didn't think that I'd ever be able to do. I didn't think I needed to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's been really interesting about my personal journey for since everything that's happened with Steve, and even since coming to Bristol, because when we came to Bristol, I used to, as I say, I used to be in big advertising agencies, living these sort of bizarre things of out from 7 till 7, or even later sometimes, and I sort of went, well, I don't want to be one of those fathers. I need to build my world around walking my daughter to school.
Yeah.
That was literally what my goal was. How do I build my world around walking my daughter to school? So I started my own business and I started all these other things that we were doing, being slightly more entrepreneurial about the way that you attack your time. But that was my goal. That was my one line. I want to walk my daughter to school.
Yeah.
And because I never got walked to school. I never sort of like, I mean, I did right at the beginning when I was tiny, but quite a lot of the time it was a very much, you go off and do your things and people's sort of money comes in, work comes in.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hard for parents. And I hear it all the time with sort of like, I see my mates, other dads, and they're stressed and they're on the phone and they're walking the kids in and they're sort of like, it's an inconvenience to them.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hard because you need to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
You need to pay the mortgage, but you also need to be able to balance that relationship with yourself. I mean, like, I want to be part of my kids' childhood.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get to their teens and they're not going to want to be anywhere near me.
Yeah.
So it's like, and then they'll come back in their 20s, because that's what I did.
Yeah.
But I sort of like, to me, it was very, very important to actually just move my life around my children and to have that. And that's probably where we got the space to have the third, was that very much of, I needed to get I needed to keep the lights on, but I needed to do these other purpose things, but I needed to be in control of all that so that I could walk my daughter to school.
Yeah, yeah. So you can choose, right?
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing that, like, work is, it's such a massive factor in mental health, I think, and it's so underrepresented because it's just, like, taken as a given that you have to do it. There's no, like, you know, my previous existence was in the city and I did a long time there, and you know, I think about the time before I left, there were kind of 4 years when I was sat at my desk thinking, I don't want to be here, but I don't know what else I'd do. And at the same time, I'm financially incarcerated because I'm on a good wicket. I'm being paid all right. I can live the life I want to live, but none of it's patching over the cracks that I'm not happy.
Mm.
And the reason I'm not happy, I don't enjoy what I do. And all the things. So then I kind of, you know, you have to engineer a path to try and make that happen. But it takes a lot of courage, I think, to sort of find your way to be, and it does take finding purpose, right? Like for me, yeah. It was like when I met my wife, it was like, okay, I've got a driver now. I need to make, that relationship's really important to me. I want to make that work. How do I make that work? Doesn't involve me living in London anymore. So in which case, maybe I need to rethink my work options. Whereas when you've just got a status quo of like, well, I'm living in London, this is where I'm staying, this is where I'm being, actually you think small about where your next move might be. It might be like, well, I'd come out of a bank and I go to a consultancy, and it's like, probably still not going to be that happy there because it's not what I want to be doing potentially. But it sort of comes back to this whole sort of sense of self-care and also what we need in life, you know, like picking up the things that we actually need to make us happy.
Yeah.
And you saying about walking your kids to school, that was exactly the same thing for me. It was like, I'll work it out because I want to be there for my kids and I will never get that chance again. I was lucky enough to be able to take some time off when my first was born. And the decision I made at that point was like, I will never get this chance again because he'll never have just been born. He'll never be 3 months old again. He'll never be 6 months old again. And so if I'm not working, okay, I'm not working. And that might have some consequences in terms of financials and all that. And I was lucky to be able to engineer that. But at the same time, I'll never be able to replace that time. Yeah. You can always replace work. You're always replaceable to some extent.
Well, why I looked at it was sort of, and I've had, because what I did was I moved from big advertising to sort of purpose-driven advertising. I went to an ethical ad agency called Republic of Everyone in Sydney, and it was the best decision I ever made, right? And it was a brilliant place. I mean, I was under so much pressure running this. I was unhappy. I'm a creative. I write ads. I sort of talk to people. But all I was doing was in meetings after meetings. And I was like, and what happens is in every business, you get pushed up this line. They throw money at you, and you sort of like, you get pushed up and pushed up, pushed up. And suddenly you realize, where the fuck am I?
Yeah.
And I did. This isn't what I signed up for. I write things. I'm an ideas person, and now I'm talking to people about money. I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And I sort of found look, this when I went to Republic, because we were all young dads. It was so good because we were able to take these things on and be more aware. And we could never work on. We only work on ethical and sustainable projects, so we had to be ethical and sustainable with our people.
Yeah.
But what I found was amazing was that. There was this one moment where I was chatting away to this other creative, and she's if she was male, she'd be running any agency in the world, right? She's an amazing creative person, but because she's just had two kids, she had to move these things around, and she wasn't finding stuff. And I sort of said to her, look, what's your blocker? And she goes, well, I've got to drop the kids off at school, and I've got to do this. And I go, okay, what happens if you start at 9:30, you leave at 3, and then you give me a couple of hours in the evening?
Yeah.
And she just sort of went to me, you can do that. I go, I can do whatever I bloody well like.
Yeah.
I want you in my department. I need you creatively in this place. If we can work around you, then we can make this thing work. And she's like, well, let's do that then.
Yeah.
And obviously I got more than 2 hours in the evening because once the kids are down, she's actually in the space and she was knocking stuff out. Suddenly I started recruiting all these mums in this same model. And we couldn't compete financially with other agencies because we were working on sort of more NGO type clients, but we were smashing the work out because we had such amazing talent that was completely untapped because people weren't working with the system, people weren't working with the school system, the 9 to 3 people weren't working with it.
Yeah.
Then move it around. And that's all we did. We moved it around. So that's what I always try to do. Is I was always trying to solve those problems and going, how do I work with great people and trying to find those pockets, if you like. And then when we came back here, it was very much of the thing of going, well, I need to be able to work out what I need as a person, as a sort of as a father, because if you don't. And like, if you don't, then you're not being true to yourself. And I flipped it because up until that point, it was always about how many zeros.
Yeah.
It was almost like, well, what pay rise? Or sort of like, I can't go down. I can't go down from that job to that job. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I reversed it. How much money do I need to survive each month?
Yeah.
How much do I need? As soon as I had a need moment and I had that need figure, brilliant. I can freelance for 3 or 4 days a week, and I've got my 3 or 4 days a month, and I've got my need number.
Yeah.
I've got it. Then I can actually spend all the rest of the time doing things that I want to do.
Yeah.
And so, need and want were really interesting for me with the way that I changed my career and the way I changed my finances. And yeah, we'd all love to be earning more money because money means choices.
Yeah.
Right. But also, money means sacrifices for me. Yeah. Right, because basically, if they're paying you 100 grand a year, then they've got to be making 150 to 200 grand a year on you.
Yeah,
right. And you're sort of, and you've got those things where that's an acquisition. You're trading your time and your energy for that amount of money.
Yeah.
So I had to take control. And I mean, over the past year, it's been more lively because there's not much work out there for those type of things. But Talk Club is now a charity, so hopefully we're going to be able to sort of make that more sustainable for us.
Yeah.
But it's been very much of that going like need versus want. And need for me was actually, okay, I need X amount of money to keep this place going. But then what do I want out of what my life is, and what do I want to be of a father, and what do I want to be my legacy on this earth, and what gets me up in the morning, what makes me happy? And you can do that. And I think there's so many blokes that I know who work dead end jobs, as they might even call it, do it for the money, but they're actually just really, really unhappy inside. And it's really hard to make that leap to the need leap. But I was lucky enough to do it.
Yeah, and I completely relate to that. And I think it's like, I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day. We were on a Zoom call, as you have been for the last year, catching up with friends. And, you know, I've kind of been doing different things for quite a long time in terms of changing my direction and going through that need conversation. He's an insurance broker, like lives a very straightforward life in terms of he gets paid a decent salary, has a nice house, all those kind of things. His life's very simplistic. Once a month, he gets some money, and that's kind of how it goes. And I've been there. That's what I did for a long time. But, you know, I've been out of that game for quite a long time. And, you know, with Born Human, we kind of, you know, we just set that up at that point. It was kind of early in its infancy. And he turned around to me and he said, "Oh, but where's your green coming from? Where's your money coming from?" And the thing is, like, you, until you've been there, you can't really explain to someone that actually I'm working in a different way now. I'm finding ways to provide enough financial support for my family. And it doesn't matter where it comes from to me. I need to be creative with that and find other ways of doing it. But that involves looking after them. It involves looking after me, making sacrifices that I don't go on holiday in the same way as I used to. And they're things that's my choice. It's not everyone's choice. It's not, you know, some people couldn't live without it. And that's cool. That's your choice. That's your need, effectively. But, you know, it's really difficult to kind of change your mindset when society has kind of driven all of us to be like, you go to work, you earn money, that gives you a lifestyle, be grateful.
Mm.
And it's like, I am grateful, kind of, but what about the bits? What about me? And what about kind of my kids? And what about our relationships? And if I'd stayed in banking and had kids, I wouldn't have seen my kids 5 days a week because I'd have been out before they got up in the morning and back by the time they'd gone to bed. And for a lot of people, that's the reality, and that's okay. And it's not me judging in any way to say that anybody's shouldn't be doing that. But for me, that wasn't right. For me, it was like, I want to be closer to my kids. And I want that time with them. I want them to know I was there, you know, and that's really tough. But it is interesting that a lot of it is down to there's courage in there. There's a lot of perspective in terms of and need in terms of whether you want to, you know.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I hold up. I've got lots of lines in my life. I hold up this line of, does it make me better? Right. So does this thing that I do make me better? This conversation we're having here makes me better. Spending some time with you makes me better.
I agree.
We've had a great conversation beforehand and we've now got some of this on tape. And but I have this thing. My relationship with my kids makes me better. My relationship with other people, like with other certain members of my family and other members of my family who I've removed because it didn't make me better. It was toxic. So I've had to remove it.
Yeah.
And when I can actually hold a line up like that, I find it really easy to actually just to make decisions on my life. Like I might take a job like we've made with. I might take a job that will be a money job because it may not be emotionally invested that I want to do. It may not be the thing that will change the world the way I want it to. But I might need money.
Yeah.
And that makes it better, right? Yeah. So I'll swallow it and I'll do it and I'll make this film or I'll do that because that line is at that moment that relieves the anxiety of money that week. But quite a lot of the time we don't do this. We don't let ourselves be selfish because selfish is seen as a sort of like looking after yourself or you're putting yourself before others. And you go, well, if you're building, like I talk about building a house every day, like in your mental health, you build a house every day, right? And if your foundations aren't on there, you're going to topple.
Yeah.
Right. But every single day, that's what you do with your life. You and some days you'll succeed and you'll smash it out of the park and you'll decorate inside all of the house, right? Yeah. That's how you do your lives. But if you haven't got those foundations, you can't do that. And and to me, a lot of it is actually about trying to find who you are and what you're doing. And like I did a talk in Oz a while ago, and then I came back and I emceed this Creative Festival, and I came back and I emceed the Creative Festival, and this bloke came up to me and he goes, "I did it," and I was like, "Did what?" And he goes, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I was like, "Yes, of course I do." "No, I don't." And I go, "Well, we met 3 years ago and we had a great chat and you told me to quit my job and do that." I said, "I didn't." Yeah. Goes, "No, you did. You sort of see, you said about just..."
"Is this an insurance claim? Yeah, is that where we're going with this?"
Yeah. But no, he sort of said, "Look, you talked about, like, we had a conversation about..." Because my talk at that festival was actually about all to do with, like, following your curiosity. Don't follow your passions, follow your curiosity. Follow what you want to do.
Yeah.
Right? And being true to yourself. And that's what he did. He did that. And he sort of, like, and he goes, that was, there was all these turning points in people's lives where you don't realize you're saying it. And maybe it might be on this. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. But you've got, to me, you've really, really got to just grab hold of something and go, okay, I'm going to have the guts to do it, because it's been sitting there.
Yeah.
Just have the guts to sort of go, like, okay, this is going to take me forward. This is going to make me a better person. This is going to make me better. And,
and
that's what I found. I found that line really, really helps me to decide whether I want to work with someone, whether I want to sort of pursue something else. Does it make me better? Does it make the world a better place? Does it make everything seem to make more sense?
Yeah.
Because you can remove it, because toxic people, toxic bosses, toxic people at work, toxic people in your family even, can drag you down.
Yeah.
And you go, "Well, I don't need that. I don't need that."
It's like the choices that you make. Like when you were talking about the lady that worked for you as a mum, like, you know, the reality is that she's, as you rightly pointed out, she's probably more productive for you in that environment because you're giving her a choice. You're saying to her, "How do we make this work?" And the system historically has been set around a situation that says, I mean, they don't call it the rat race or 9 to 5 for nothing. It's like that's kind of a universally accepted fabric of society to some extent. And it's brilliant. You know, the world is changing, definitely, in a way that, you know, people don't function like that. COVID's accentuated all of that because people are working from home and all those kind of things. But what it's proving more and more and more is the fact that to be productive, to be a contributing member to a workplace, doesn't mean I have to sacrifice my home life. It doesn't mean I have to sacrifice who I am as a person. I can deliver on both levels if you give me the flexibility to do that. And in truth, I guess that's how we should be focusing. I mean, that's certainly where Born Human came from for me, was like, this is the wrong way round. We need to be thinking about, if people are happy, then they're productive, they're creative, they're so much more intense in terms of what they can give employers, and as a result, everyone wins.
Well, this is the thing, these rules. I mean, like, for example, if I go to the gym in the morning, I won't get out till 10, half 10, I'll come back here. And now, in my head, I've got 4 hours. I've only got 4 hours because I'm picking the kids up at 2:30, right? Because my wife's off doing her PGCE and sort of, like, she's now in the school for 3 days a week. And so I've got 4 hours. So it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy to make those things. But that's a choice I've made to have kids.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to put them into after school club, or I wanted to do those things, then again, that's a choice that we've made. But what happens is, it's about the flexibility and about what you do with that time. And I think that there's lots of stuff where when it comes to my feeling when it comes to parenting, and it comes to parenting and this relationship with work and with stuff like that, we play by the rules. The rules can change, and we play by these rules. And my job is as a problem solver. This is a problem. Just try and solve it.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favourite ones was in Sydney. We were in Bondi, and there was someone there that was setting up a morning after babysitting service. Now, that is genius to me, right? Because what would happen
where
is...
Where do I sign?
Exactly.
I jump on a plane now.
Exactly. You're sort of like going, like, please, someone set it up in over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But what was brilliant about it was that, like, any parent knows that the night is actually, the night of babysitting is actually is a functional thing, right? Yeah. I need someone legally to look after my children so they don't die when I'm out, right? So can you turn up at 8 and stay till 12 because we're going to this thing and we don't want to miss out?
Yeah.
But the whole time you're there, you're in the back of your head going, I can't. One of us has got to stay soberish because we've got to pay the babysitter for a start and we've got to make sure that sort of like that all works right. And then one of us, and that same person is getting up in the morning.
Yeah.
And like with our three kids, we're sort of like, we're up at 6, right? So, but what I need is I need that space between 6 and 9 or 6 and 10. That's what I actually need the next morning. So someone get, I will pay proper top dollar for that, right? And what they were doing was they would turn up at your house at 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
Get the kids dressed, get them all sort of like, you leave all the kids, even in the, if they're in pyjamas, chuck them out, take them to the park.
Yeah.
Take them around, get them all, go and buy them whatever they want or whatever, your decision. Come back to you with a bacon sarnie and a cup of coffee. Then you're going like, that to me, like you think how much you pay for babysitters per hour? And then you go, I'll double that in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll double, that's danger money, I'll double that. But that's solving a problem.
Yeah.
And to me, there was a problem there that no one else was going for, but it was a problem that we were all feeling. And that's the same when it comes to sort of like the way that we looked with trying to work with great talent who happened to be mums and couldn't have that time. And I think that's what we've had to do with COVID. But also, it doesn't mean that we have to go back to the old way, and it doesn't mean the Zoom is the answer as well.
Yeah,
right. I think it's actually about like we need to be more respectful of each other, and we need to be able to work out how to work with each other instead of work against it, like this dictatorial sort of standing over you, logging your hours and stuff like that. Right. Yeah. Now, there's a great thing with Netflix, right? So there's a book written by the HR, the head of HR at Netflix, and she sort of said they got rid of holidays,
right?
And I was like, okay, and because what they do is they actually found that holidays were a problem they created anxiety.
Yeah,
what they found was that people just need X amount of time to sort of like, they want to go on holiday a couple of times a year for a thing, and they want to take a couple of days off here and there to go and see their kids play sport. Right?
Yeah.
So what they did was they got rid of it. You don't get 20 days a year. You get whatever you like.
Yeah.
Right. So it's your choice with your team, your responsibility. Right. And then what happens was when they can actually do that, you start taking, that's a cultural thing, you start taking that on and you go, okay, I'm going to take this holiday because I need this holiday because I'm taking responsibility for myself, right? And I'm going to take this time off, I'm going to take that time off. And if you're spending so much anxiety worrying about other people, then you're going to be an idiot and you're going to go like, you're not going to take any time off.
Yeah.
But that's your problem. That's your fault, right? And I had this with before with like, I remember a junior account handler who wasn't working into me directly, but worked for me, if you like. But, and she was sending me emails at 11 o'clock. So I sat her down the next day in the evening. I sort of sat down. I said, okay, something's not right here.
Yeah.
Right. Why are you sending emails at 11 o'clock? Right. If you think that impresses someone, it doesn't. Right. Yeah. All that seems to me is that you're not coping because we've overloaded you, or you've got a wrong attitude in some ways. Why is this thing? She thought I thought I was doing the right thing. I go, no. I don't want an email after 6 o'clock because that means you're not looking after yourself.
Yeah.
You haven't, your time management's not there, right? And if your time management's not there, we need to look at that because as an employer, we need to make sure that you are better with this.
Yeah.
And that's what you see quite a lot of the time is that there's very much this like in France they ban the email after 6, and it's sort of like, and I think that's what we should be doing. We should be sort of like looking at the way that our anxieties pass on to other people.
Yeah.
Like if I do send something after 6 with some people I've been working with, I'll go, I don't want an answer on this until tomorrow.
Yeah, be very clear on the fact.
Yeah, and I've said that. Do not open this till tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Because
that's a red rag to a bull sometimes, but it is also like you're stating your intentions to say someone's probably going to open it, but they don't feel the pressure to kind of respond to it or reply.
But it's also about how I as a manager need to be talking to that
setting
person.
Setting an example.
Yeah, I go like, this is the thing. I'm, like, I know, or I might apologise. I might sort of say, look, I'm sorry I'm sending this so late. This is my issue.
Yeah.
Right? But what happens is that we've built this culture in this country where we just work 24 hours a day. And yeah. these phones are the worst thing for it because yeah. you can get me anytime, anywhere. And when clients are now working on WhatsApp, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I'm added to being added to WhatsApp groups. I'm like, no, that's personal thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I should sort of sit next to my wife and my friends and my family. I don't want to be hearing about this.
Yeah.
But I think it's but again it's responsibility. You can turn those notifications off.
Yeah.
You don't have to look at your email. You if you set that rule with that you don't have to do these things, then you start looking at everything else. Like, for example, simple tip. Don't sleep with your phone next to you. Like, buy an alarm clock.
Best advice
that I was ever given. Buy an alarm clock. Because you buy an alarm clock, you leave your phone to charge downstairs, the alarm clock wakes you up, you don't look at your phone till 9 o'clock or whatever.
Yeah.
Or if you need to look at an email, but you're not the first thing you're picking up, because you pick it up straight away and all the stress just seeps back into your body again.
Yeah.
So, but we've got to take responsibility for it. Like the way that I try and use my numbers and sort of like with Talk Club, I'm taking responsibility for it. I'm not letting the world happen to me. And if I sort of feel I'm unhappy with something, I'm going, does it make me better?
Yeah.
And I'm going, okay, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to work that way. I'm going to work this way. And I'm going to get the result you want, but I'm going to work this way.
Do it my way.
Well, it has to be, because we sort of like, because to me, my kids have got to come first, and my relationship with my family's got to come first, my wife, and then my relationship with myself has got to come there.
Yeah. It's all relationships, isn't it? That's the crazy thing about it, is that actually this is all about human interaction and how you deal with people. And actually, if we're all open to the fact, if we're respectful enough of each other to know that life is complex, and as long as we're choosing to be committed to work, family, friends, those entities in their own right, and we choose to be, then actually that commitment, like you were saying about the Netflix thing, it's like, take the responsibility to look after yourself. And it's about trust at some level, where you say, I trust you.
You got to trust.
To deliver. Yeah. I trust you to give me what you need. And to be honest, if you're not giving me, you'll be the first one to judge yourself if you're not delivering what you want. Yeah. If I'm saying to you, take as much holiday as you want. Right?
And you've got to trust yourself. And you go like there's the famous one of whether it's true or not, but Branson, sort of Richard Branson, only works one week a month. He turns on for 1 week, and then he turns off for three.
Yeah.
And you sort of go like, and whether that's true or not, you go, I love the idea of that, because you're taking responsibility. And what I do is I work better at night.
Yeah.
I always have done, right? So sort of like, I might start working on something at 10 o'clock. I'm not finished till 2. But I've got that as my... I'm taking responsibility for what happens around the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and what it, that's going to do in the morning. Yeah. You know, yeah. You
and
manage it.
And it can make me better as a parent, because all I've got to do is I've got to do those moments.
Yeah.
But I think that there's so much of that where you go, it is a lot of responsibility for yourself, and it's a hard line responsibility, but you like you've got to know what you. You can't let people dictate your life for you. And it's really, really hard, because when you're in a big business and money starts dictating it, and mortgage repayments and sort of all these things, and as you say, the nice holidays, you go like, if you start bringing it back to what do you need versus what do you want and what makes you happy, like to me, I'm happier now than I've ever been.
Yeah.
I earned more money when I was 17.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of like, so I know that those two, and I've been lucky enough to earn a good salary at one point in my life. So I know that, but it didn't make me any happier.
Yeah.
And so we know, and again, as you say, it's everyone's different, but to me, it is very much about like, what are those things that make you who you are? What are those things that you want? You want to, there's a lot of things, when you earn lots of big money, you burn out.
Yeah.
Right. So then how do you make yourself sustainable? How do you sort of like, we talk about a lot with the environment sustainable, but human sustainability is what I work in now.
Yeah.
And how do you make yourself sustainable? How do you keep your, you happy so you can make everyone else around you happy?
Yeah. yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? And it's the responsibility ultimately lies with all of us to kind of, rather than just being dictated to, but taking that ownership and saying, this is important to me. These are the things in life that are important to me, and how do I make them serve me? How do I make that work in the environment that I operate in? And if things need to change, then things need to change. Not always the case, you know, plenty of flexibility that people can offer, but it is finding that balance. Tell me a little bit, I'm interested, before we, I'm conscious of time, but tell me a bit about Our Kids, Our Lives and what you're doing with that.
Yeah, so that's the next film, Our Kids, Our Lives, and we're looking at the mental health of children. And what I found was that throughout the journey of Steve, so people who haven't seen Steve, it's about my childhood best friend Steve Yates, who took his own life, and how this is the biggest, I mean, the thing most likely to kill me is me, right? It's now the biggest killer of men under 50. A man dies every 90 minutes in this country, right? And so what I did in Steve was I looked at it as I talked to his family and looked at my own journey. But then most of the film is looking at solutions.
Yeah.
Most of the film is actually trying to make a positive impact. And quite a lot of the film, the way that documentaries are made, most documentaries are made up until quite recently, is that they're made by journalists who document the way the world looks at stuff. So they'll hold a mirror up to it and they'll go, life's crap, and you'll go, life's crap, and by the end of it you'll go, life's crap, and call us Marins, right? So what I needed to do was I needed to fill it with solutions. And when I was going round promoting the film or screening the film, I did like 49 screenings like up and down the country, and trying to find male dominated places and pubs and sports clubs, and like we met in a sort of co-working space, didn't
yeah.
we? But it was sort of like, but again, it was run by a bloke called Jamie, who was very into sort of men looking after men. So it was a very, very great space. And what I found was that when I was doing this, I was on lots of panels. The idea was to sort of bring people from local areas into these, and they could talk about the great work they're doing. So that was the idea, to sort of not just just almost like use the Steve film as a Trojan horse,
to like sort a catalyst.
Of get, yeah, to get male men talking and to sort of go, look, mind here. Or, and one of these chats was with Papyrus, and so Papyrus is a youth suicide prevention charity, and just listening to one of these women talking, I was like floored. I was floored because. Like in their statistics is that over 200 school children take their own lives every year. I've since found out that sort of 7% of children under 17 have attempted to take their own lives.
Right.
And you sort of, when you look at these things, and we know what's happened over the past year, as is even getting worse. So I remember coming out of that moment, that talk, and walking back to my travel lodge, and just feeling completely flat, completely empty, and going, I never want my kids to feel this way.
Yeah.
I never want anyone to sort of like, and I since talked to sort of lots of people who'd lost parents who lost kids to suicide. And they're normal kids, they're normal parents, they're just like me and you, mate.
Yeah.
And just things got confusing, things got out of control, and unfortunately these kids got thought that the world would be better off without them. So I decided to take that on. I said, okay, I'm going to make a Steve-like film, a problem-solving film. Steve was described as a change-a-mentory by a very kind journalist one time, and that's why I try and make my films now.
Yeah.
So Our Kids, Our Lives is like that. It's looking at what's going on, why it's happening, but then also all these amazing things that we can do to help us. And one of my hopes is that I'll use the Talk Club network. We've got over 2,000 men now. Where I'll try and empower fathers, and I'll try and empower brothers, and uncles and granddads,
yeah.
to sort of talk to their kids, talk to teenagers, and talk to even primary school kids, and try and get them into the language of opening up. Try and get them into sort of maybe even to the out of 10, and make feelings more open. So yeah. That's the hope of the film. As per usual, it's. It's a big thing and didn't know whether I'll be able to do it. But so far we've raised 12 grand. I need about another 12 to sort of make it. I've got great feelings, and we sort of like we did. I asked 100 parents to sort of do me videos. You did me a video,
yeah,
and sort of like about what's worrying them, and some of those responses are amazing. And you sort of you go like inside that, just the research from that, and how open some people are, and how worried some people are about. And these are many of these are friends of mine who I know are good people,
yeah.
And so I know that this is almost like, again, this silent killer. It's like it's the biggest killer of young people. Suicide's the biggest killer of young people.
Yeah.
So you go, and now coming out of what's happened with the pandemic, this is only going to go up unless we try and do something about it.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm going to just try and highlight all these great people doing great things.
Yeah.
Try to make the same sort of connection that we did with Steve with men. We're going to try and do it with parents this time.
Yeah.
And try and just sort of try and sort of go, look, here's all the skills that you, here are the things that you can do as a parent, but also these things you can do as a kid. And we've got like, I mean, I've got this amazing interview with a young lady who so I think she's 15 or 16, talking about her battle with anorexia for the past 9 years.
Yeah.
Past 7 years since she was 9. And it's just amazing. It's just like literally I watched it and was crying.
Yeah.
And I've got like poems from sort of a young boy who we've turned into an animation, him talking about it's called likes and sort of like social media and sort of the pressure he's done on that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I start filming again in July.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing. I think when you talk about kind of following your passions and following the things that you're curious about, and kind of would you have ever have, like, it's weird how the word kind of comes together, right? And and actually when you put it into that context and explain it like that, you can see how Steve has driven a change, not just for men but for kids, and for raising awareness around it and all that, trying to change the future, I suppose, and not just kind of deal with the problem as it stands. Because, you know, for our kids' generation, it's kind of, they're going to have a totally different outlook on mental health, which is a great thing. But there's a bit of work to do, it feels to me, in the interim, which is like the transition from a place that we were in about mental health to the place that we need to get to. And there'll be a generation or two in the middle that sort of sits there and goes, I'm not sure which side of the fence I fall on. And something like this gives them a great outlet to kind of go, okay, well, it gives me perspective on a subject that isn't talked about. You know?
Yeah. I mean, the main thing that I've noticed with it, no one wants to talk about kid suicide. Yeah. No one wants to say those words. I mean, I wrote a piece yesterday, child suicide. Those words should never appear together.
Yeah.
Right? And even just saying it now, you mean, like, it sends a shiver down my spine. It makes you feel uncomfortable. Yeah. We do. We don't want to talk about it. Yeah. Right? But it happens. It's happening. And there's thousands of parents who it's happened to. And also the other thing inside that is that we as parents we pass so much pressure on ourselves that eventually, whether we like it or not, goes on to our kids.
Yeah.
And now I think it's harder now to be a parent than it ever has been, because we've got to do it this way, we've got to do it that way. You're a bad parent because you give them they look at their phones or you give them sugar or you're sort of, and we judge. And yeah. One thing that I was really wary of, and it's come up a little bit already, and I haven't really sort of, as I say, we've all been in lockdown, but came out of those videos was very much this feeling of don't be judged. As a parent, I'm not criticizing anyone, but I know that when this thing comes out, if someone's going to go, oh, well, don't do it like that. There's a TV program about the best parent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The competition of strictness versus openness. Right. Everyone's going to do it their own way.
Yeah.
But for me, my goal with Steve was to save a 38-year-old man. My goal with this is to save a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Right. Because boys, again, we think that there's so much more pressure on girls, and there is.
Yeah.
But boys are more likely to take their own lives.
Yeah.
So how do I protect that boy, right? How do I create that thing from when they're 8, and hopefully they keep them going? But that transitional period between when they go to secondary school is the biggest point, apparently.
Yeah.
From what I've my early research. But that, and that manifests all the way through the sort of secondary school, and girls with self-harm and girls with, but what we're doing is we're as a society is piling all this pressure on them, and then we're going, oh, don't worry, we can sort it out, we can sort it out.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of it is coming from parents.
Yeah.
I mean, like I had a great one, which is sort of like, we're saying that our phone's bad. I talked to a head teacher, our phone's bad. And he's like, well, okay, if you look at phone as a knife, and I've got brilliant, I love this already, right? You look at phone as a knife. In the right hand, a knife can create amazing dinners, right? Yeah. It can, like, put it in the right chef's hands, it can create these amazing things. In the wrong hand's a killer.
Yeah.
Right? That's all phones are. In the right, or you look at phones as junk food, right? Yeah. It's okay for them to have McDonald's every now and again, or something junky every now and again, right?
Yeah.
But if they're on it all the time, then if they're going to eat junk food all the time, it's going to muck them up.
Yeah.
So just simple things like that, when you can actually reframe, because to me the way that I work is all about reframing,
yeah,
like mental fitness or looking at it as junk food. Because we go, like, if you look at it as technology as junk, you go, it's okay to have a little bit. It's okay to have those little bit of endorphins.
Yeah.
It's okay to sort of like feel that little bit of sugar and salt flying through your system, right? Yeah. But if you have it all the time, it'll muck you up.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we do need to do as parents, not sort of like, no, you can't ever have sugar, or no, you can't ever have salt.
Yeah.
But actually use it in moderation. And those to me, those are hopefully the things that will, that type of stuff will be coming out of the film.
Yeah, and I think that's incredible, because you've got like a, you know, we both know, certainly, and any parent knows, that there is no right way of doing it. There is no such thing as a perfect parent. And yet social media and all those other outlets around us profess that there is. And I don't know, we're kind of sucked into that, but at the same time, it's difficult to avoid it in day-to-day life. But having the sort of self-assuredness to be like, no, 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 I'm doing what's right by my kids, and the only person I need to be accountable to for that is me at the end of the day, or me and my partner, and, you know, to make sure that what we're doing for them is the best we can do by them, you know, and not be judged by other people. I think it's amazing. I think it's incredible. I'm going to spring you with a question now at the end, which I think I'd like to get from all my guests, which is, what one piece of advice would you give to either your younger self or to your kids now for when they get older?
Be yourself. It's an easy one. Yeah. It's a simple one. But like, but I was saying that to my daughter this morning, and I think it was the best bit of advice that my mum ever gave to me, was just be yourself. Like, don't, like, I spent a lot of time as a kid trying to please other people, trying to be someone I wasn't, trying to sort of fit in, trying to do that. And what happens is, if you can be yourself and know who yourself is, then you will, people will gravitate to you. Like, yeah. my kids are always different, but my son is very much himself, and people gravitate to him. And my eldest daughter is a beautiful human, but what she does, I can see her worrying too much about what people think. And it could be an age thing as well. But also, she worries so much. She always has been worried about so much about the way that people react to her. And if she was just relaxed and be herself, then people would gravitate to you.
Yeah.
And I think when I started doing that, when I was just being myself, when I started picking that up a lot more in my 30s and especially in my 40s, I found life is so much easier.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd have done that earlier.
Yeah.
And I just spent so much time trying to go, okay, I'll be who you want me to be, like an ex, a previous partner, or my work would want me to be this person, or like. But as soon as I can put that line in that, and I'm going to go, okay, I'm going to be myself now.
Yeah.
Then everything else just works around you.
Yeah, yeah. Things come to you in a weird kind of way, and it's having the faith that being authentically you is good enough. Like, it doesn't, you don't need anything else. The world will find the right things that gravitate to you.
Right? Yeah, I mean, like, I've always had a bit of girth. I'm never gonna be the fittest man in the room.
Yeah.
And as soon as I accepted stuff like that, as soon as I accepted that I'm not gonna be Brad Pitt when it comes to my physique, when I accepted that there was all these things, when I could be myself.
Yeah.
I was so much happier.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it. I think what I find is, like, when I sort of say, what we talk club about, how are you out of 10, people go, that's too easy. It's too simple, that.
Yeah.
Too simple structure. Like, we need something a bit more complicated. You can see their eyes.
Yeah. I've got a 20-page questionnaire dying for you to fill out.
Yeah, and I'm just sort of like, and when I say something like those lines of, like, does it make you better or just be yourself, people go, oh, that, and that. I mean, this is sort of something that sort of sits on an inspirational thing you buy and stick on the wall. It's actually the fucking truth.
Yeah,
because you can actually, you interpret it, but it's very, very hard to do. It's very, very hard to do. You sort of like, you like for example, when you can find a partner who lets you be yourself.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Like my two previous long-term partners wanted me to be someone else.
Yeah.
And then when I met Claire, I was sort of like, finally, I can be myself.
Somebody just loves you for you. It's an amazing feeling, right? Yeah. And actually, it gives you this, you get this kind of sense of peace that is like, I don't need to do anything other than just be me, which is a weird sensation. Yeah. And I think school and those kind of places are rife for kind of trying to drive you into places that you might not choose to be, but you sort of feel like you need to. Survival means you need to fit in, kind of thing.
You look back on those people those people that you went to school with who were allowed to be themselves, who had the confidence to be themselves.
Yeah,
and they are so much happier now. You look back on them and you go, I know that person. Like, there's a bloke called Rob Shelley. I'll give a big shout out to Rob Shelley, who was just be himself. He was himself when he was at school. And I have so much respect for the way that he dealt with himself.
Yeah.
And I see him now. We caught up like maybe 18 months ago before COVID. And I was so proud of who he is and the way he is as a person.
Yeah.
And he's just always, as far as I've seen him, and he probably can sit here and argue that he's he doesn't do that, but he's always just been himself.
Yeah, you know what you're getting.
Yeah, and I used to respect him so much for that, and I always like look back at it, and even with Steve was very much himself. He was sort of like he would play. He wouldn't worry about other people's worries on certain things, and I think that thing came in a lot more when in his teens and into his 20s. But when we first, one of the things I used to love about him was he was just himself.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing, and I think that's an incredible way to kind of end this and kind of give people something to take away from it. It's pretty simple, and I think a lot of the messages that have come out of all the work you've done are simple yet really effective, and there's lots of people that are benefiting from them. So I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on. It's been a real pleasure to have you on. I'll post links and share and widely. And if anyone out there's got 12 grand they want to throw at our kids, our lives, we'll try and get that out there as well.
I just want a grand off. I want a corporate sponsorship from a grand from each 12 companies.
All right. So 12 companies out there. There's the challenge. We'll try and find them. Thanks for your time, Ben. It's been really great to have you on.
Thanks,
mate.
Have it. That's it for this week's Born Human podcast. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed that conversation. Ben's someone who I came to meet completely spontaneously when I caught wind of the fact that Steve was being shown in Bath through social media or somewhere a few years ago. And spontaneity wasn't something I did then because I had a 2-year-old, and who has the time to do anything spontaneously then? But I'm so glad I did. I had the opportunity to meet him, and he's become a great friend and a great connection over the years. I have so much respect for everything he's achieved with Talk Club, with Steve, and now moving on to Our Kids, Our Lives, and what that is going to do for our kids' generation. And I think for me, when I conceived the idea of this podcast and about exploring people's journeys and talking to inspirational people, he really meets that brief in that he's someone who gets on with trying to make change for the better of our community and our society, and he really lives and breathes that whole ethos. And I think for me that's a real thing to behold. If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, then please check out the show notes and we have some links. If you're also keen to support the work that he's doing with Our Kids, Our Lives, there is a crowdfunder running, and I will happily share details of that on there as well. So if you can spare a few pennies, I know you'd be grateful. Thank you to you for joining us this week, and to Ben for taking the time to share his journey with us today. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. So I'll see you at the next Born Human podcast.